KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
You wouldn't have taken such a sketchy deal. And neither should you, the American people. Because the math doesn't add up.
When we're talking about math that doesn't add up, how about $4 trillion of deficits over the last 4 years? $5 trillion. That's math that doesn't add up.
I will get run out of
town.
I just described to you precisely how I do it with a single number
that people can put, and they can put their deductions and credits into that bucket.
We're keeping track, I promise you.
That was the feisty debate of this week that we heard from President Obama, former Governor Mitt Romney, and moderator Candy Crowley, who I think we would all agree was standing there. She was ready to go.
Why did they wait so long to put one of the female people in there to moderate?
Yeah, why did they?
Why did they?
Well,
she was,
you know why?
Binders.
They didn't have binders full of women that they could.
They apparently didn't have binders full of.
She was easily in the binder. Come on, you guys.
Yeah, they apparently didn't have binders full of people of color either.
Nobody, right?
Well, then.
All right. Well, then on that note, may I introduce you all? That was Essex Porter from Cairo TV here with us. Thank you for being here, Essex.
Thank you.
Knute Berger, who is from Crosscut and other places. Thank you for being here.
You bet, Steve.
And Joni Balter from Seattle Times. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And Eli Sanders from The Stranger. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
I'm working on a more pleasant moderating tone. I'd say
Steve is downright skippy today.
Skippy. Did you all watch both debates, governor's debate and presidential debates?
Yes.
So I can go around. I didn't get to ask you that beforehand.
Not the governor's debate, but I did watch the presidential debate.
All right.
What? It was on the wrong channel?
It was on every channel the week before, and I watched all of that.
All right.
Then you pretty much saw it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I
took a break from the governor's debate, too.
Is that right?
Yeah, I've seen like four of them.
It was a marathon anyway that evening. It was like, is this an endurance contest or a night of TV?
Wow. All right. So, Eli, just a tone, just a note on the governor's debate. What was the tone like?
Well, I mean, I thought it was interesting, but it was very familiar. The tone was a little more confrontational, but not as confrontational as the presidential debate. And, you know, I didn't learn a lot, I got to say. Huh. I'm glad they did it. It was worth doing. But I don't think a lot of new ground was covered. The most interesting exchange I thought was over reproductive rights. And they got really far down into the weeds over who actually supports what. And I'm not sure that there was any light actually shed on it in the end, but they both, Inslee was trying to paint McKenna as not supporting reproductive rights, which a lot of reproductive rights groups afterwards came out and said, yeah, Inslee was right. But McKenna did a very very good dance around all the areas that were uncomfortable for him on that issue. He presented himself as someone who is pro-choice, although I think a lot of people in the pro-choice community would not agree with that.
As you have said.
Yeah.
This is not the first time we've heard that, yeah.
That's what I'm saying. All of the issues on the governor's race at this point, we're on pretty familiar ground.
Both governors, the two most recent governor's debates followed either the vice presidential debate and in this latest one followed the presidential. And I guess one thing that was going on is that after the break, you take a break. You either take a break of a half hour, an hour and a half, and then you get to the second show, which is the governor's debate. And they seemed mild, tame by comparison, especially this week when whatever that body language was between those two roosters on the stage in the presidential race. It just seems so tamer.
All right. Before I go to the two roosters, how does this race feel to you right now? I mean, are the issues clear enough that voters who now are going to be, you know, they have their ballots, they have their pamphlets?
Polls show just a really too close to call race. It's going to be very close. That's what it looks like. And in some ways now it's in the hands of, you know, there's how many ads does everybody have? Everybody has lots of ads, but are people watching these on TV? Are they absorbing them? Are they burned out?
How does it feel to you, Essex?
I agree with Joni on the ads. I think both campaigns, there seems to be more of a negative tone to the ads. Both campaigns really seem to be trying to punch an opponent's vulnerability. So both campaigns, that tells me both campaigns feel it is close, that they are both within striking distance, that the Inslee people, even though they have sort of a nominal lead or a lead just inside the margin of error in the polls, don't think they haven't won yet. And the McKenna people feel like they're close enough. They might, if you sort of look at the polls, they seem to be to have some momentum. And especially when you look at where the polls, what the polls are showing for Western Washington and King County, it doesn't seem like that Inslee is not quite to the traditional 60% that a Democratic candidate needs yet.
May I say officially, since I didn't do that, I wanted to make sure I had your title exactly right, and I didn't have it in front of me. Essex Porter is senior political reporter for Cairo TV, and Joni Balter is assistant political editor for the Seattle Times. Knut Berger is editor-at-large of Seattle Magazine, and Eli Sanders is associate editor at The Stranger. One thing they are clearly, if you watch the ads, both campaigns and at the national level too, they're concerned about women, and they're going for a woman's vote in that. That's what I'm seeing. What are you seeing?
Well, yes, that's really important because that's a huge part of the suburban swing voters, for one thing, both independents. But they need to pick up Democrats. The McKenna campaign needs to pick up a certain number of Democrats. Of course, we talked about this last week about how some people are promoting a kind of Obama-McKenna vote. I think they have drawn pretty clear distinctions between themselves in debates. If you look at Inslee, you think jobs and green. If you look at McKenna, you think fiscal conservative manager and education. And I think, if you put those all into one candidate, you'd sort of have the perfect Washington candidate, particularly. And both of them are trying to attract, not just their bases, but they're trying to get the swing voters. And I think the momentum is maybe slightly with McKenna because he's the polls show him coming up a little bit, the race tightening from where it was. You had Inslee ahead 6 or 7 points. Now it's maybe, 3 mm-hmm. points? Internal polling, I don't know what that shows, obviously. But he's probably helped a little bit by Romney's surge, a little bit. I think it's going to come down to turnout. Will Democrats and Republicans, who's going to get the most folks out? Because you can see that in a number of districts here, swing districts, they tend to tilt slightly more Democratic in presidential election years. And partly I think that's because it's in recent years – even a lot of moderates, became very tired here, became tired of George Bush and whatnot. So, I think it's going to come down to turn out who's got the real motivated people.
Well, let me go back around the table. Why you said that Jay Inslee had not yet reached that 60% magic number in King County or parts of Puget Sound. Why do you think that is? What's the electorate not hearing?
I think part of that is because the electorate here is very comfortable voting for Rob McKenna. They've done so twice. If I remember correctly, Rob McKenna did better statewide in 2008 than Barack Obama did.
Actually, that's true.
Huh. Mm-hmm.
So they're comfortable with McKenna. McKenna has, especially in his recent advertising, has taken a comfortable tone with folks. I thought his earlier advertising seemed a little intense, but the more recent advertising, when he's doing the positive ads, that's someone you can be very comfortable with. Well, and we were talking about him needing to get Democrats. This recent Washington poll shows McKenna with 5% of the Democrats, Inslee only getting 2% of the Republicans.
It looks like what President Obama is facing too in terms of independence, and that's nationwide. One of the ads that's come out, Eli, is from the from the Inslee side, though not the Inslee campaign, is the Tea Party appearance ad. Mm-hmm. Clearly going to trying to label him as an extremist. What is happening, though, that there's this momentum for Rob McKenna, do you think?
Well, I feel like I actually haven't taken a close look at the recent KCTS9 Washington poll.
Yeah.
It's one of those things.
It's one of those. But I don't know that I've seen a surge for McKenna. It seems like Inslee has pretty consistently stayed at least 2 points ahead. But obviously Inslee wants to highlight McKenna's Tea Party associations as much as he can to drive down the vote for McKenna in King County. I think it's all about King County, as other people have alluded to here. Having not looked at that poll, I don't know, did it show the current spread in King County?
It doesn't show it by county. It shows it by Puget Sound area. So in the Washington poll in the Puget Sound area, Inslee is getting 54.7%. McKenna getting 37.7%.
So but, not quite as you're saying. At
right,
the,
not quite at 60%. And I went back and looked in that 2004 election that was so close. Gregoire got about 54%, a little bit more in King County. And Rossi won Snohomish and Pierce. That's why that was so tight.
Mm-hmm. Really? Huh.
So I want to go back to the female vote. And by the way,
in all this?
I want to see one attack ad that has a male voice, just one. Okay. But
well, you have those Inslee attack ads, McKenna attack ads, right?
Where it's with the grumpy old
the
guys.
The old codgers that around the
like,
table. Yeah.
That was probably cut in New Jersey. Not one of them seemed like they were from the Northwest in that ad. Just saying. So one thought about it is there was this big, you know, just a few weeks ago, there was a big gender gap with women. The traditional gender gap is with women favoring Democrats and men favoring Republicans and the difference between them. It was at something like 18 percentage points before the first debate. I saw the morning of the second debate, the gender gap had collapsed. It was down to 1 point favoring Obama. So that is one reason why the race is on for women voters. Nationwide, there are 10 million more women voting than there are men. So it's a big group. Now, how does that trickle down or resonate here in the state of Washington? Quite a bit. Washington also has 53% of the electorate are female. So everybody's talking to women. But what's interesting, and now I'm going to sort of change point here, the ads in both cases seem to me about both candidates have said they are not going to raise taxes. So what the ads seem to be trying to do the work of, I'm not going to raise taxes, but that other guy over there, let me tell you why I think he's going to come around and raise your taxes. And both campaigns and both ad narratives are doing just that. So it's the property tax swap. Inslee accusing McKenna he's going to raise taxes. There's a radio ad. There's another ad about Inslee's history over time in different, either when he was in the legislature or in Congress, votes that he may have taken. So they are both saying the same thing. I'm not going to raise taxes, but that guy over there, keep your eyes out.
And the awful truth is that neither of them can do what they're promising without raising taxes or raising revenue of some sort. I mean, from my point of view and from the point of view of a lot of people who look at the mess our state is in, that there's not a solution without raising revenue. And so they're both kind of boxing themselves into a bad spot for the next 4 years.
One of the things about this property tax swap, when you talk to school directors, especially around here, the property tax swap does make the richer school districts, Seattle, Bellevue, Lake Washington, Redmond, have to go ahead and contribute money to the poor school districts. And I just wonder, that's not something I'm really hearing from Inslee. I'm hearing it more generically. But is that an opening for him to raise that issue in King County and thereby raise his percentage of the vote in King County?
That's interesting.
Yeah,
socialism.
We've wondered that, too, whether he would try to it's kind of a King County nativist card that he could play. And it's...
Did you not see the ad? He's from both sides of the state.
Well, that's...
But no, I get your point.
In a little line there.
Let me ask you a last question about this, and then after the break, we'll go to the two roosters. The Washington poll also has an undecided category for governor. And in, well, you know, Puget Sound, 7% undecided. Eastern Washington, 8% undecided. Male, 7% undecided. Females, 7% undecided. A little higher, actually, there. Skip, what's going on? Canute, what's going on with that? Where at this time, undecided seem to still be the ones that are going to decide this race.
If they ever decide.
If they ever decide. Yeah. well, I think in the governor's race, it's because both guys have run to the middle in different ways. When was the last time a Republican ran in the state as the education governor? I mean, that just hasn't happened before. Somebody who's a guy's run for governor saying, I want to spend more money on education. So that's I think, what he really believes, but it's also part of a calculation about what appeals to certain voters and what he thought would work in this election cycle as well. So, you know, you have Inslee you know, getting kind of on the bandwagon with at least appearing to on education reform issues and, you know, maybe moving to the little right of the teachers union on that. So, you know, they're sort of snugging into this category, and they've both fit certain, you know, kind of archetypes. McKenna's portrayed himself, I think, as a very pragmatic, problem-solving kind of guy, and Inslee has staked out turf that I think works very well in Washington, which is the optimism, the vision, the we're special, and I'm going to make us even specialer.
And the rugged outdoorsiness. I don't think we can discount that. Like, visually, they hit that over and over again in their ads. The Inslee campaign has a commitment to good lighting that is above and beyond, you know, anything that the mechanics.
Anything that we see outside.
Yeah, except in that Clinton ad they did. I can't believe the lighting they allowed in that Clinton ad.
The production values on that were not.
No.
That was a quick turnaround.
I would say another thing I think that's going on, and I wrote this very early in the thing, is whatever you think about each of them ideologically, they are decent, solid, experienced guys. In other words, you have candidates who are, in a sense, closer to being equal in terms of I think depth of experience and seriousness. And we haven't always had that in our governor's races. You know, often we've had you know, these huge contrasts between somebody like Gary Locke and someone like Ellen Craswell.
Yeah, and also in you could say that about our presidential race in some ways too, it seems right now.
Although I would say that's not the tone that McKenna was trying to strike in both of the last two debates. I mean, he hammered over and over again this idea that Inslee had his facts wrong or didn't understand state issues as well as him. And so
he's a Washington, D.C. congressman without a sense of what's happening
and
here.
He's trying to suggest that Inslee is a lightweight when it comes to Olympia, which there was a little bit of a sense of early on, and I think Inslee has obviously overcome that. You just have to look at the polls. But McKenna does not want the general perception to be what Canute is saying, that they're roughly equal. He wants, I think another part of what he's running on is the idea that he's the smarter guy in the room.
Well, they never want that. But I mean, you're saying that's what we're seeing.
I'm saying that undecided voters are seeing people who are two solid candidates, regardless of ideology. And I think that causes some people to want to stop and listen and pay attention and think about it.
You were going to say something?
Well, what I observed actually on those debates was that in the third and the fifth, which was the final debate, there was more of this sort of, I'm telling you how you debate. Let me die, especially from McKenna toward Inslee. This is how you debate. And, you know, you're coming up short, of course, but this is how you debate. In the fourth one, there was less of that. There was none of it, actually. I didn't notice it at all.
I agree.
And I thought, well, wait a sec. So either that's an effective technique or it should be used sparingly, or what's the deal with that? Does that trigger, I don't like you?
You know, by the way, on the KCTS Washington poll, the Tea Party, as you would expect, 90% for Rob McKenna, 6% for Jay Inslee, 3% undecided. All right, we'll take a break and come back and talk about the presidential campaign. This is Weekday.
We have cloudy skies in Seattle, 57 degrees in the University District. Forecast calls for clouds all day with a chance of showers, the high in the upper 50s. Clouds and showers tonight, the low in the mid-40s, cloudy through the weekend with a chance of rain on both days. Tomorrow's high reaching 50, the high on Sunday also near 50.
Support for KUOW comes from the Master Builders Association Remodeled Homes Tour, featuring 21 projects throughout King and Snohomish counties. Remodelers for each project will be on site to answer questions. More information at remodeltour.com.
Nearly a dozen young women, all Western tourists, have died mysterious deaths in Southeast Asia over the past few years.
They were healthy when they arrived and they were dead 2 days later.
Police say a reaction to pesticides, but a researcher thinks it could be murder. I'm Guy Raz. That story next time on All Things Considered from NPR News.
And that story on Weekend All Things Considered tomorrow evening at 5 o'clock.
Why don't we talk about the arena as well, since the Memorandum of Understanding was signed this week? We will get to that as well as we review the news of the week with Knut Berger, who's author of Space Needle, The Spirit of Seattle, Eli Sanders, associate editor at The Stranger, Joni Balter, assistant political editor for the Seattle Times, and Essex Porter, senior political reporter for Cairo 7 News. Well, you said the two roosters, Joni, so let's talk about what happened at that debate.
That's such a girl take, isn't it?
Well, here I was telling you about Stewart and all. Stewart also had... Jon Stewart on The Daily Show did their reaction to what was happening. And one of their points was, why are all these people saying, like coming down on women's issues, or that, oh, this is women can't handle the debate. They don't like fighting. It just seemed very much denigrating.
Women are the most impressionable based on the numbers I mentioned earlier. If there was an 18% gender gap 3 weeks ago, and then after one debate, you know, it's down to no gender gap. They're very impressive.
But what was it about that? What was it about what happened in the debate that closed the gender gap?
The first debate.
Well, you know, I wonder. And what I think happened is that Romney kept, you know, who had not done this before, was talking about the middle class more than he ever had. He swam a million miles away from 47%. In that debate. Mm-hmm. And Obama was, you know, off his game and didn't say anything. There were a couple of cases where he didn't do binders full of women. But what he did do in the first debate was mention the women in his life. And I don't know. So the women just, he just seemed more like someone you could, who, the whole issue for Romney had been, he doesn't feel, you know, maybe I'm mad at Obama, but I don't think Romney's the guy to fix it for me. And in that debate, he seemed like he was listening to people. Mm-hmm. I think that's why the women went that
way. I think it's a great mystery. I mean, I have the same question. And one thing I noticed in the second debate was that Obama brought up Romney wanting to defund Planned Parenthood and some of his other extreme takes on reproductive rights over and over and over again. And I don't recall it coming up in the first debate. So that may have been another contributor, that the first debate just didn't touch on reproductive rights as much, which...
But it didn't touch on a lot of topics. It didn't touch on the auto bailout. It didn't touch on the 47%.
Right. But if we're groping,
I mean, there were so many
why
pieces of what didn't happen
in female support toward Romney. I don't think anyone's successfully explained it.
Do you have any thoughts? It's a tough one.
I don't think I can successfully explain it either.
Do you? I mean, it was so fascinating.
Yeah, I don't know, and I don't know how relevant it'll be in another week or two. You know.
Well, what did you learn in the last?
I think what we learned about the first debate was that impressions about the that Obama and Romney are somewhat flexible and somewhat there's some volatility in where people are. I personally think that's primarily because of the economy. I think it's primarily a sense of four more years or not, you know, change or not. I think that and I think what we're finding is there's some sort of, you know, Obama's kind of walking on gravel there a little bit, you know, with the capacity for things to sort of slide away. Now, it'll be interesting to see, you know, see what happened. I thought he did really well in that the second debate. We still haven't seen numbers that indicate whether that's going to have a lot of effect, but it seems to have, at least between that and the Biden thing, it sort of has stopped the fall. And it'll be interesting to see what happens after that. But I think the kind of, you know, the attitudinal stuff I think is significant, but I also think it's moves a lot.
And one other way of looking at it is that Obama's support is soft, that it's movable, that it's flexible, that if Romney puts in a really good performance, women will and other voters will go, oh, all right, let me rethink that one.
It's worth just throwing in again that correct me if I'm wrong, but the biggest movement we saw here was in the national polls. And again, the national polls don't really predict or they don't tell you anything about what matters, which is the states themselves and the Electoral College.
I was looking at so I've been reading Nate Silver's 538 because he's such a master of analysis of the nitty gritty. And I did not realize that the third debate in historical terms has had the most impact. I always thought it was the first debate. But in historical terms, the third debate has had the most impact on changing
the
outcomes.
Third presidential?
Yes.
Well, the first presidential debate, it supposedly, is the most watched. But the reason why everybody, when they get the coin toss, it wants to go last is because, I'm just guessing here, the third debate is the last word, right, from that medium point.
So did you learn anything new about either Mitt Romney or Barack Obama, Essex, in this last debate? Or come away with a new perception?
Boy, I hadn't thought about whether there was anything new I learned about either candidate. I don't think I heard anything new. I thought I heard especially President Obama present his ideas in a sharper manner, but neither candidate surprised me, although I have to say I was a little surprised that Romney set himself up for the rebuke on Libya.
That was a surprise, wasn't it?
Yeah.
But that gets you to this coming Monday night, which is the third debate.
Just to say real quick, that was did President Obama use the word terror or terror attack?
Act of terror. Yes.
Yeah.
Romney raised the phrase act of terror, which is precisely the phrase that Obama used. Romney could have criticized him in other ways, but the trap is that he used the phrase that the president actually did use the morning after the attack.
Yeah, you were going to say.
Well, so for Monday night, which is the foreign policy final debate that you say is so impactful and or that Nate Silver says is so impactful, you know, foreign policy the entire time up to this point has been net gain Obama because he got, and I hope I don't blow this, Osama.
What did he do with Osama? Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Don't you set me up here? I'm not. You know, he got rid of him. But so now because of Libya, there is some, and they were. This is when they were when the two roosters were in each other's face quite a bit the other evening. Like call the Secret Service almost was over this issue. And over Libya. So this next debate focuses on foreign policy. And I just wonder, you know, we've been talking about women voters, but I wonder about the issue of foreign policy. Is that now neutralized over the Libya thing?
You know, I seriously doubt that the Obama people feel it is neutralized. Neither would the Romney people. They may try to do the Libya attack better, but I think what they will probably do is push harder on Iran and push harder on the Middle East. While the president will do something that he did a little bit, that he's done a little bit, but sharper this time, which is to keep asking the question, so who do you want to go to war with, Mitt Romney?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think you'll also keep hearing the phrase unraveling before our eyes, which we heard from Paul Ryan and we heard from Romney. And that just gets at the general sense. And I think Joni actually alluded to this several weeks ago, that when you turn on the TV and you see foreign reports, it's kind of a mess right now. And so Romney just says, you know, it's all unraveling. And then he doesn't have to explain what's unraveling and what he would do different. And it's up to Obama to kind of trap him in that. But I would imagine that we'll hear that phrase some more from Mitt Romney.
Yeah, well, I agree. I mean, I think Romney has two weaknesses on foreign policy, and one is kind of throwing in with neocons. He looks as if he wants to start a war everywhere, you know, you know, whether it's bombing Iran or somehow getting militarily involved in Syria. I mean, what? Can you name an election where the Middle East wasn't blowing up in some way? I mean, it's always happening. You know, there's always an issue there. And the question is whether, you know, a president seems presidential. And that's where for both of them, the gaffe thing is important. I mean, we remember, wasn't it Gerald Ford that said that Poland wasn't behind the Iron Curtain, or, you know, kind of thing. And he should have known better, and it became – and it played to this idea that he was a kind of mistake-prone, slightly – you know, slightly clueless, and that I think was the significance of the Libya thing in the second debate. Of course, Obama's problem is that when you're president, the buck does stop with you. Whether it's the Libya thing, which he took responsibility for, or just about anything else people are seeing on TV, because we have this kind of double-sided thing, which is we don't want America engaged in the world, but we think we're in charge.
And that was a very effective moment in the debate when he said, you know, Clinton had come out that day and claimed responsibility. And right. I think Romney was ready to, you know, pounce on that and say, who's responsible here? And Obama, before that could happen, I think Crowley had asked him a question, and he stepped forward and said, I'm the one who's responsible. And that, I thought that was one of the many very good moments in the debate for him.
And
so
he
gets to have it both ways.
You will certainly on Monday night hear about Romney's trip to England, where, it's supposed to be so easy to go to England and just not say anything that's upsetting to anybody, you know, except maybe something about their food.
I was just going to say the downside of having the third debate on foreign policy is that foreign policy tends to rank very low on what people care about when they vote.
Well, I was going to ask, don't you think that any time a foreign policy question by Bob Schieffer is raised, they're going to go, Bob, the best foreign policy is jobs, and here's my plan for jobs.
Exactly. I mean, the more you'll be able to skew that back on the economy. And so I think it's unfortunate that the last debate is on foreign policy, and that is kind of a must-win for both of them, because it's one and one, and you want the two candidates want to win the next.
I actually really liked the debate that mixed foreign and domestic policy. I thought that was the most natural and effective way, and I hope that ends up being what happens in the third debate. We've seen that both candidates are very, very good at talking about what they want to talk about regardless of the question. So as you suggested, I mean, hopefully they'll steer this back around.
And that'll depend on the moderator as well, if the moderator can keep control, you know.
Bob Schieffer is a tougher moderator than Jim Lehrer. But
he's no Candy Crowley.
or Martha Raddatz. Let's go.
No, I don't. I don't. No, he's. I would say and he's on my station, so I'm definitely a Bob Schieffer fan. I think he will acquit himself very well, and I think the candidates will not get away with as much as they might think they're going to get away with. They certainly didn't when they appeared on Face the Nation.
No, and he has the skill of doing that every week, doesn't he?
They go back behind the podiums, am I right? So it's not that sort of get in your face, walk, you know, measure how close each candidate gets to the audience on which question and all that.
May I ask, just on the questions that were raised, how did you feel before the break? How did you feel that Candy Crowley did as a fair moderator? Her charge was to, you know, was she going to be in the background, or was she going to hold their feet to the fire? How did you feel she did?
You know, I was with the audience when she did the real-time fact check. You notice the audience applauded. They were told not to applaud. They applauded anyway because they weren't applauding the candidates. They were applauding her, and so do I.
I agree. I thought that was a really great moment where she did what everyone needed a moderator to do, which is state what's true when both of these guys were, you know, at each other about different interpretations of the truth. And I also thought she did a very good job at the beginning of hanging back. You know, there was a number of quite long stretches at the beginning where she just let them kind of go at each other. And I could imagine that her temptation would be to really rigidly control the debate after all the concern about the out-of-control debates before. But she did a very good job, I thought, of letting go when it suited the moment and then reining it right back in when she needed to.
Well, one of the things was the day of and the day before, if I have this correctly, she had mentioned that she was going to somehow, like, break the contract, go rogue. And so I thought. And apparently both campaigns complained in advance and said, wait a minute, you know, these details are all worked out in advance.
Yeah, too bad they didn't work them out with her, because she wasn't part of the contract.
Right, but she was saying, you know, I'm going to be so active. And then she did hang back there at the beginning, and it was a mixture of hanging back and inserting herself like that. So
I like the image of her going rogue.
Well, I'll tell you one other thing, and she discussed this afterwards, is she insisted on being able to stand. because Jim Lehrer sat and the candidates were looking down, but he was below them. I don't know what Bob Schieffer will do, but by standing at eye level with the candidates, it was easier to stay in control.
He should get the Patty Murray phone book so he's at their level.
There was a great Michael Kinsley column this week about how what facts don't matter in the debates is especially numbers as much as logic, that you can sort of demolish the sort of Romney-Ryan approach to Social Security and Medicare reform by simply talking about what they're saying and the logical consequences of what they're saying. In other words, if you're going to save Social Security for young people, it means they're not going to get as much as the people before. So you don't need a number to determine that. But they won't come out and say that. They won't come out and say, well, yeah, the younger people aren't going to get anything, or they're going to get a voucher or whatever. So but that said, and I think it's a really good point, which is somehow getting beyond moderation of debates that's simply asking a question and letting the answer happen, but having more more analysis by the moderator of the arguments being made. And I have this vision of it also with the fact checking, that the moderator ought to sit there or stand there, and there ought to be an intern on either side with computers fact checking each of the candidates and feeding the moderator data.
I like that idea.
In the middle of the debate, so that it's much more of a, hey, wait a minute. Because I think that's where you actually get them having to think on their feet. And that's where you not just see mistakes, but you can get the it forces them to the logic of their argument, not just the soundbite.
Should we also let them have a lifeline?
They should definitely have a lifeline.
Yeah. Maybe to their wives. Maybe.
Only to their wives. All right. Let's take a break. We'll come back. Let's talk about what's happening in our region as well with Knut Berger, Essex Porter, Eli Sanders, Joni Balter on Weekday.
Later today, we'll get the story of Anne and Nancy Wilson and the rock band Heart, as told by Seattle music writer Charles Cross. His new biography of the band is called Kicking and Dreaming. Charles Cross is our guest this afternoon at 12:20.
Support for KUOW comes from Storybook Theater, introducing young children to live theater with 55-minute interactive musicals. Now presenting The Three Pigs in Seattle, Kirkland, Renton, and Everett. Information and tickets at storybooktheater.org.
It's 10:42. I'm Andy Hurst. This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle, news and information. We have clouds and 56 degrees in the University District. We're expecting clouds and rain all day, the high in the upper 50s. Cloudy and rainy tonight as well, the low in the mid-40s. Cloudy through the weekend with a chance of showers, the high on both days reaching 50.
Support for KUOW comes from the Snoqualmie Tribe Fund, caring about community stewardship and culture, proud supporters of the Seattle Symphony. More about the Snoqualmie Tribe and its community investments, programs, and services is at SnoqualmieTribe.com.
All right. Now then, Joni Balter, assistant editor, Seattle Times, Knut Berger, author of Space Needle, The Spirit of Seattle, and writes the Mossback column at crosscut.com. Eli Sanders, associate editor at The Stranger. Essex Porter, senior political reporter for Cairo 7 News. You know, Essex, I wanted to ask you something since you brought it up. I'm curious. You said that they didn't do a very good job on people of color in moderating debates either. And bringing up a question then overall, and it's not, I think it's to all of you, but since you brought it up, I ask you, what do you think about this election in terms of the needs of the concerns of immigrants, of people of color, of people who speak second languages? There's a lot of issues that have been left out of both the national and the local debates. Is that typical?
I'm not – in the national debate, I'm not sure those issues have been left out.
They're there. Well, immigration was definitely
there. Immigration's definitely there. Making the economy work for everyone is definitely there. And that's basically the debate between Obama and Romney, making the economy work for everyone. The people of color are not always sort of, name checked in the debate.
Yeah.
Name checked.
Nor are they a block.
And nor are, they're certainly not a 100% monolithic block, but you still see very strong preferences among Latinos, very strong preferences among African Americans. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, in that sense, the latest polls statewide show Florida tipping towards Romney and Nevada tipping towards Obama, and it's the shift in Southern Latino voting in Florida and in Latino voting that's in part.
Is that post-second debate polling or
pre? I just saw it
pre?
Just now. Okay. And I thought that was interesting because they're looking at the Latino vote in that.
And there was maybe you're looking at the same story, but there was a story in the New York Times this morning that said quite a number of states, I think beyond that one, are seen as hinging on the Latino vote.
Yeah, that's both interesting, isn't it?
See it.
All right. I didn't mean to interrupt.
Oh, no, go ahead.
All right. Let's take a look at what's happening locally. And since you mentioned the stadium, we're going to talk about the stadium deal, Knut. The memorandum of understanding was signed, and now there will be an EIS. And there's a lawsuit by the Longshoremen's Union saying the EIS, the Environmental Impact Statement, is not the challenge. It's legality because there's only the one site plus another site to be named. But is this rolling along from your perspective?
Well, it is rolling along. I mean, it's really incredible when you think about it. regardless of what you think about the stadium, it's pretty amazing that, a hedge fund guy from California shows up at the beginning of the year and completely alters the civic debate. We were talking about cops, schools, all kinds of things. And suddenly the front burner issue becomes an arena, basketball and hockey arena. And, of course, gets into everything else. It gets into shipping. It gets into the port strategy. It gets into gentrification. It gets into public versus private. All those kinds of issues. And I think it's amazing to me that, given where it started out, that it got this far.
Yeah.
That it didn't get derailed by, and Chris Hansen said this week at one point, I'm glad I didn't listen to the people who told me that, don't waste your time on Seattle process. In other words, that don't think about putting a basketball team there because the process of Seattle will kill it. And so far it hasn't. Now, the lawsuit poses a challenge for the city. And they still have a lot of details to work through. As you say, they have to do the EIS. One thing I was really struck with this week, Chris Hansen came down and talked to the Crosscut editorial board, and we filmed it, and it's going to be on the Seattle channel at some point. It was just a great conversation. But I was just really struck with what a great salesman that guy is. I mean, there's a reason he's a hedge fund zillionaire. I mean, he is just a very
smooth. He probably made
smooth,
a few good bets, too. You know?
Smooth guy. And he's a local guy. I mean, not only sort of bleeds the Sonic green, but, he grew up working class Catholic in the Rainier Valley and just a few blocks from where I grew up. So we had a chance to kind of talk about the neighborhood. And that he's really figured out that both to be a successful sports franchise owner in Seattle, this is not a Ken Baring kind of guy, the big blowhard from California who's
with the moving vans. Remember
exactly.
His moving vans?
This is a guy who part of his business strategy, I mean, not just in terms of kind of an ethical strategy, but part of his business strategy is creating a sports franchise that's really wedded and embedded with the local community in terms of what it can do for underprivileged kids that will find basketball inspiring, as he did when he was growing up. And so there's almost a kind of, social do-gooding thing that's woven in. And those things, I think, are very appealing to folks in Seattle and help overcome a lot of the skepticism.
You just have to look at it the way you said that, how artfully this was done. The thing I noticed about Chris Hansen is the more people are sort of angry with him or challenging him, the smoother. He just never gets rattled that I've seen. He just says, well, this is what I want to do, and I'm going to navigate as best I can. And look, he's got two council votes. He's got a lawsuit on his hands. That'll have to be figured out, or maybe that was already figured in.
Well, I think one of the things they figured out on the lawsuit was it simply looked at the process of siting the tunnel that's going to run under downtown, which was sited and decided on long before the final environmental impact statement came out.
I talked to someone on the east side this week who is really hoping that Seattle process blows up so they can get that arena for Bellevue. And this person was predicting that that is what would happen eventually, that that somehow this deal is going to come apart. Classic Seattle problem with the lawsuit or whatever. And
saying that, because it has become one of the most effective arguments for getting stuff done in Seattle. Whenever things start to teeter off the rails, people bring up the people on the east side salivating, and then things sort of get back.
Then they all go back and work together.
Do you think that this is everybody has gotten on board in one way or another? Council members who want to run for mayor say we've done our due diligence. The mayor said we've done our due diligence. Is this in the end off the table in terms of a campaign next year as an issue?
Well, it kind of depends on what is going on at the time, because, you've got a Tim Burgess who can say I made the deal better. You have a Mike McGinn who can say I stayed with this. This is, something I marshaled through. Sure, these other guys came along and, how the council tinkers and does a few things. But this is my project, so I have this. But it just depends on sort of how big the lawsuit becomes, how big a deal is what I mean, and sort of what happens next if people feel that it's actually analyzing the other sites or if that's just window dressing and all of that.
It also opens an opportunity for it. I don't think anybody thinks there's only going to be a couple of people in the mayoral primary.
Oh, my God.
I mean, I think there's a long list of potentials, and they're going to wait and see. But it does, I think, open an opportunity for the skeptics, whether that's a Peter Steinbrück or
he's in a funny position on that, though, because he ended up working for the port, and he's very much a likely candidate for mayor.
But there are people who who are very concerned about both the public subsidy and the location. So it does create an opportunity on both sides, I think, politically.
We should mention one thing about the EIS process. It does not make a decision. The EIS could say some other place is even better than Soto, but the elected officials make the decision. And if the monetary support is in the Soto and they can mitigate what the EIS says needs to be mitigated, it can still go there. It doesn't choose
the site.
That's
a really good point.
But that would definitely be something to fight over in the mayoral race if that's the timing.
The EIS tunnel
says one thing and the city's going to do another. That would be an opening.
That's interesting. Real quick on this one too, the fight over the appointment of a monitor to oversee the reforms in the Seattle Police Department that the Department of Justice and the Seattle City have agreed on, the public fight between Pete Holmes and some council members and Mayor McGinn on one person or another person, is this an extension of the strategy that we saw in the entire public debate over the DOJ, or is this something very particular that unhinges the sort of compromise that came in? Did any of you follow that and get a sense of that?
I did not follow it closely, but this comparison to what happened with the DOJ and the consent decree, I think you have Mayor McGinn in a strong mayor system who is a lawyer himself with strong lawyers in his office, wanting to be sure that the mayor still controls the police department, and he gives very grudgingly and very slowly on things that are going to take mayoral control away from the police department. And I think it could be anything. And of course, this monitor is a very important decision.
Yeah, and you have Pete Holmes on one side and the council members. I mean, this is they're having their fight in public.
What else is new?
Yeah, and talk about campaign issue for 2013. Public safety and the police are going to be a big one.
All right. You guys are journalists, so I'll ask a journalist question to end this out. The Seattle Times is taking out some ads in support of some candidates and issues. So for Rob McKenna and for the yes on same-sex marriage, and they're taking it out in part. They say they're taking it out to show the power of newspaper advertising, and that it still has power and impact. We talked to a Poynter Institute journalism expert and asked him if it was unprecedented.
Given the long history of newspaper journalism in America, I can't say that it's unprecedented, but it sort of stands out as remarkable.
So, full disclosure that since you work at the Times, We will not make you represent the Times, Joni Balter.
I'm not even
authorized.
Not what you do. I'm not even authorized.
You are unauthorized.
They have a, you know, the company has a very competent spokesperson, and she is sort of answering the, because this is a corporate decision, she is speaking for the corporate side of things.
So I was wondering how anything parsed is, I mean, all this stuff gets parsed. You guys take ads. You guys benefit from the ads. You guys take ads from politicians as well. You guys take ads at the Stranger and also support candidates. How is this different?
This is different because taking ads is different than purchasing ads, which is what's happening here. The Seattle Times Company has spent $80,000 to run a full-page ad for Rob McKenna every single day between, you know, yesterday or the day before and Election Day. With the intent of showing the power of print advertising. And it's also doing a roughly $80,000 ad donation, which you can basically call an ad buy, for the Approve 74 campaign. That's different than, you know, writing endorsements or something like that.
But how is it different from the Stranger having, you know, you guys were accused of running a Mike McGinn for mayor campaign by putting him on the cover.
On the cover in all the boxes.
So here's the difference there as well. And I'll help you out by making an even clearer comparison. You know, we've been criticized by the McKenna campaign because Dan Savage has donated to the Inslee campaign. And Dan is the editorial director of The Stranger. And I think there's been at least one other donation to Inslee from The Stranger, I think. So what's the difference there? The difference is that The Stranger does advocacy journalism. The Stranger tells you where we're coming from, and we're open and transparent about our orientation and biases if we have them. The Seattle Times brands itself as nonpartisan objective journalism. That's just, they're different styles of journalism. And so in the one, you know, having someone in power at the paper buying ads for a candidate is not necessarily a problem. In the other, it is. And, you know, I don't necessarily have to be the one to argue this. You have more than 100 journalists at the Seattle Times who just signed a letter saying what their publisher has done here is undermining their credibility.
Right.
Their
and so that was.
I just want to make one distinction there. Was Dan Savage writing about the issue that he had contributed to? Because none of the writers on the news side would ever do that.
Contribute money to a campaign they're also writing about.
Yeah, Dan's blogged quite a bit about the governor's race. And I think he was co-bylined on a feature this week in The Stranger about Rob McKenna.
So I'm curious what you all think about it as well, because there is what the ethicist said, Roy Peter Clark said, was this is all about our being the public's perception and understanding of what the role of the media is. And in this world of confusing roles, is this one more bit of confusion? How do you look at it?
Well, I think it is another bit of confusion for the Seattle Times. And I think, I think they just blew up their brand. I think it's a huge mistake. Because I think that their brand, you have an advocacy newspaper like The Stranger. They're very honest, straightforward. They you know, if they're for the monorail, they're all in on the monorail or whatever it is. And readers come and expect that. At the Times, you expect this real sense of we are objective in our reporting. That even with their endorsements, you know, we have all the candidates in. We talk to them. We make a reasoned decision. The idea then of actually donating essentially to campaigns with these in-kind contributions for ads for both the referendum and the Rob McKenna. I think it just really muddies that water. It plays to a suspicion people already have, which is the paper is not objective. And here you're mixing a business agenda and an editorial agenda. And people don't always make the distinction between editorial page and editorial staff, you know, news
staff. I get that.
People don't often make the distinction between advertising and editorial anyway. So I don't think it's – I mean, I think a lot of people think the Times is already biased, and the Times has had to fight against that. And I think he just undermines the newsroom, because I think those people, you know, by and large, are really working hard to not have those things overlap.
You get the last 30 seconds there, S. Exporter, if you have a thought.
Yeah, I have more faith, and I think we should all have more faith in our readers, our listeners, our viewers. You know, if they are engaged enough to be interested in our stories, they are also smart and savvy enough to know when there is bias in an individual story and not just say, hey, everything I read or hear or see on some news outlet is biased.
All right. Essex Porter is senior political reporter for Cairo 7 News. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And Joni Balter is assistant political editor for the Seattle Times. Thank you.
Thank you.
Knut Berger, Crosscut. Thank you.
Thank you,
Steve. Eli Sanders, Stranger. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all for listening. Have a good weekend.
It's 10:59. Headlines from NPR News, less than 2 minutes away.
Support for KUOW comes from University Volkswagen Audi, committed to providing customer care through the exclusive Passport Service Program, which includes service loaner vehicles, rideshare shuttle service, and a knowledgeable staff. More information online at uvwaudi.com.
This is 94.9 KUOW FM Seattle, 1340 KUOW Tumwater, 90.3 KQOW Bellingham, and digital.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.